Welcome to Through the Keyhole, home of the Association of Laparoscopic Surgeons of Great Britain and Ireland podcast, putting innovation, technology and training at the heart of surgery. We want this to be a two-way dialogue, so join the conversation by emailing hello@ttkpodcast.com and do share with your medical friends.
Hello and welcome to the Through the Keyhole podcast. We're into series two, and today I am delighted to welcome Paul Barrack from Thomas Jefferson University. He is an anesthesiologist, health service researcher, critical care physician, and much, much more. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Great, Tan. Delightful to be here.
Fantastic. So you're in the United States. You've just been telling me what a busy schedule you have. And of course, in the middle of this, I've interrupted your day, but I'm delighted to get you onto the podcast because we're tackling some difficult things in this podcast. I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the inspirational, the challenges, and those situations in medicine that we don't really want to get into. So just tell us a tiny bit about yourself. You've done incredible amounts of research. Into which field in particular?
I've been lucky to be part of a team of research for the last 20 years that's focused on a fundamental question, which is the performance of individual physicians and teams, as well as the performance of teams of teams. So, for example, performance of anesthetists or surgeons, performance of surgical teams or ICU teams, or performance of hospitals across multiple departments, divisions, service lines, in an effort to improve what we call the quadruple aim, the safety, the quality, the satisfaction and joy of the staff, and also the financial wellness of the organization.
So those last four things, safety, quality, satisfaction of the staff, and finances, are often pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that can be quite hard to fit together. So tell me, of those four things, which ones do you find most difficult to engage the staff with?
Well, I think they're challenging because we look at these things as in a piecemeal way. And we forget to realize that complex systems, as one of my mentors, Paul Batalden, has noted, these systems perform exactly as they were designed, which is not very well. Healthcare systems, especially tertiary care, are probably the single most complex human endeavor. The physical environment, the organizational environment, training the staff, recruiting them, supporting them, keeping them on their game. These are really, really hard things to do. We've trained physicians in general, and especially surgical physicians, anesthetists, surgeons, to think that they can do their craft irrespective of anything and anybody. And that fundamental flaw means that the idea that there's a system upstream and downstream that is highly dependent on the actions of these providers seems to come as a lightning bolt to a variety of providers who think, not my problem. I don't know. Yeah, whatever. Who cares if the people that are sterilizing my surgical laparoscopes are getting paid properly? Who cares if there's enough lighting so they can actually see that in the crevices of the Da Vinci robot, there's abundance of bugs that are hiding? Not my problem. And so we don't really train people in a cross-disciplinary way. We don't train them to think about the interprofessional nature of a complex, for example, a laparoscopic surgical case, or for example, maybe one of the most complex procedures, you know, an aortic aneurysm repair, when you have to deal with the brain, the heart, the spine, and of course the aneurysm. And then you have a complex team working with supportive radiologists and imaging experts and then nephrologists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm struck by, I've been in healthcare. I trained in healthcare at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And that's a little over 20 years now. And I came from spending 5 years in the military as a physician, and I'm struck by how much more we could learn from the military in teaching providers to think differently about hierarchy, to think differently about interprofessionalism, to think differently about the role of human factors. This idea that when you're tired, you can be at the top of your game, as once a junior surgeon told me, is just silly. I mean, we know that after 24 hours not sleeping, we feel miserable, we're cranky, we're not at the best as we deal with challenges to our authority or complex dynamics. In the military, decades ago, we had rules for this. Unless it was a true emergency, you stood down. You don't just continuing, you know, to work when you're making bad decisions because you got no choice. Now, of course, emergencies are emergencies.
Yeah.
And we know that, but I'm talking about the elective, which is the majority of the problems, the elective performance, which we know that fatigue and noise and distraction and alcohol and poorly supported teams dramatically reduce our performance and, of course, harm patients. And it seems also contributes to the PTSD and the moral injury that we're seeing more and more as well.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that, but just to unpack some of those things. I identify with that. My 22-year-old son has just joined the British Army. He's an officer, and his training was nothing like the training that our junior surgeons get. His respect for authority, the delineation of rules, and you've just said how you manage with fatigue, emotional problems. You know, what makes the military run through walls for their comrades? And I guess there are a couple of things. Do you know what really makes people, you know, put the ultimate sacrifice of their life for their comrades?
Well, my own feeling from being there and speaking to people and reading research all lines up. They do it for their comrades. They don't do it for the larger mission. They don't do it for country in spite of all the patriotic jingoism. They do it because they don't want to let down their buddies.
Yeah.
They do it because there's a mutuality that begins from day one, that we survive together or we sink together. And that mutuality, that respect, that accountability, that leaning in to make sure my buddy gets over the wall, as opposed to what's in it for me, is really the cornerstone for the best performing military units.
Yeah, I think respect, civility, trust, humility, those four things are so important.
Yeah.
So the military aspect is really, really fascinating, and I completely get what you're talking about. Would you say that the complex systems that we work in, how do you think we should best address this? Because there are several problems that you mentioned. It's the recruitment, it's the training. You know, the military spent, you know, let's say 80% of their time training and 20% doing. We do the reverse in medicine.
If we're lucky.
Yeah. What's your answer for that?
Well, I am struck by the fact that we spend so little time formally learning. You know, this idea that somehow when you finish your internship or registership, you're somehow ready to go, when really you're just at the precipice, the beginning of a journey of daily, weekly learning. And so this idea of instilling vehicles of accurate reporting. For example, we know that surgeons in the UK report maybe less than 10% of their adverse events. We know that anesthetists in the US report less than 2%. We as physicians don't report these things because, well, we don't trust the system. Yeah. We don't think there's great value out of the system. We're afraid. We're afraid what our colleagues will think about us. And so we begin going back to your point about the humility and thinking that if I had a mistake, my colleagues are going to think worse about me. Therefore, I'm just going to keep tight. I'm not going to say anything. Even if it means a patient might be harmed, we're always afraid of dubbing out a peer, even though we know that when you look at Shipman and others, there were telltale signs years earlier in Bristol, in mid-staff, there were telltale signs many years before it exploded, but colleagues felt, I'm not going to say anything. It's not my place. I don't want to get them in trouble. And so that type of accountability to the issue, I think, is such a paramount thing. And it starts with the ethics of why are we doing this work and how do we make sure that that doesn't get violated as we try to get the work done?
I've just been reading Christine Porath's book, Mastering Civility. And she just does say, you know, what's the most important thing that we all ask ourselves? Why am I here? Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And those examples you've just given are, they replay in every single hospital. And I can say, you know, as a junior surgeon, if there was an adverse event, or if I was with a boss, you know, I've not reported stuff. I know I haven't, because, you know, the patient ultimately was okay. But actually, yes, those, you know, we know Heimrich's ratio of 1 to 30 to 300. We need to learn, yep, from those 300 near misses.
And 100%.
We simply don't. So,
and when you look at, I mean, when you look at the Japanese Shinkansen, one of my favorite vehicles to travel on, goes at about 260 kilometers an hour. It's been operating for about 59 years. Its average delay per year, Tan, is about 4 seconds per year, per year. Wow. And in 60 years, it's never had, underscore, never had a major crash.
Yeah.
And if you watch the pride in how they're dressed, how they talk, it turns out that after every day, they have 4 sessions of debriefing where there's time to say, you know, we're working all day. There's no time to sit down and debrief and reflect. And so building in time into operations and say, we must learn, including from the people that clean the trains, including from the people that maintain the engines, not just the people that drive the engines, et cetera. And so there's an embedded culture of learning, of reflection, of speaking up. It's expected that you'll speak up. All these things are building blocks, I think, for a culture of safety, of truthfulness, of transparency, and ultimately of meaningful teamfulness.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that meaningful team concept, because I find it very difficult to debrief. Everyone wants to go home at the end of the operating list. Sometimes you're having to drag people back in. And I think that's part of our culture that's not quite right. And I'm going to bring you back to that word culture. There's so much we can talk about, but culture is everything. I've just been reading Satya Nadella's book, the CEO of Microsoft, Hit Refresh. And he talks about in one section about concept, capability, but ultimately the company, the corporation, has to have the right culture. And those three C's are really, really key. And I think healthcare has got quite a difficult culture. There's a comedian, well, he was a doctor who gave up medicine, called Adam Kay. I'm sure you've read his book.
Yes. Yes.
So that's on the BBC at the moment. And, you know, my wife, who's a doctor, and I have been watching it. It's been quite painful to watch, actually.
Delicious and painful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an adaptation of the book. But, you know, there is just a culture of abuse which we've normalized.
It's exactly that, the normalization of deviance. You know, so Diane Vaughan, who coined that concept, a great book on the Challenger disaster, argued that years before the disaster, this event was already being laid down. The DNA for this event was being laid down. Nobody could see it, of course. But when you encourage people, in the case of NASA, to bend the rules, you encourage them to crazy deadlines, you scare them not to speak up to power, then you force them to put their ideas into PowerPoint bullets to try to measure uncertainty. And of course, all these smart people working with thousands of people in different nodes, not seeing, there's not transparency, there's not truthfulness. And then there's a political master saying, we're going to launch one way or another. You can see how the engineering, the risk, and the political worlds clash. We see this every day in the NHS or in my hospital, where you have to get through the list. You know, there's the political mandate to get through a number. There aren't enough staff because of a variety of reasons, you know, and so people push the envelope. And when they push the envelope, they can't see the risks that are adding up, because they're opaque to them. You know, Jim Reason's famous Swiss cheese. Yeah. I like to call it the Camembert cheese, because all these holes kind of, like, you know, they all kind of get squished together. And it's hard to understand how an incidental event, I have three boys, and they'll do something and they think it's innocuous. And then you try to tell them, well, that thing will lead to all these other things. And they go, ah, you're just an old man. You know, you keep on locked into these old stories. It's okay. I've never seen a problem. I had my 12-year-old years ago when we were talking about infections and hygiene. And before lunch, I'd say, do you wash your hands? They go, smells okay to me. Can't see the bugs. Can't smell the bugs. It must be okay. And I think a lot of times around safety and quality and complex surgeries, we tend to take that thing that if we can't see the problem, it's not there.
Yeah.
And yet we're performing at a high level of technological sophistication, high level of performance, and we do it every day in and out. And we assume it's easy to do, but doing a hard laparoscopic case or a multi-vessel CABG, these are really complicated things where a lot of things can go wrong and do go wrong.
Yep.
But our inability to acknowledge how hard they are because we do so many of them seems to create for management the sense, yep, it's one more tick box on an Excel spreadsheet. There's a lot that could go on every day.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lack of understanding at times what management doesn't really understand, the fear of being at the sharp edge and the ability to make a misstep that could lead to a wrong side surgery, leaving a sponge behind, an extraordinary catastrophic event that could end a career for a surgeon, or certainly embarrass them in such a way that they'd be on the front page of the Telegraph, and that would then cause dramatic downstream effects.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, I think we've gone from 25 years of starting with surgery that was, or medicine that was relatively simple and safe, to having highly complex and highly dangerous surgery and medicine. And we've again normalized that, which leads us nicely onto the trauma. And, you know, I'm a surgeon. I should be absolutely flying. I've been a consultant for nearly 20 years. And what you've just described, you know, not seeing the problem. In fact, as you get older, decisions are more important than incisions, and you start to slow down. And I call it mindful surgery. You start to see problems that you just used to ignore. You described it beautifully. And, you know, you've articulated something that we all face. And when we hold the mirror up to ourselves, the what we've actually put ourselves through is quite interesting, and it bears on future decisions, as it were. You know,
absolutely. And I mean, the other big thing, as opposed to other high performance entities, sports, military, space travel, we don't do coaching in medicine. Once you finish your formal training, you're on your own. If you're smart, you hook up with a mentor. If you're smart, you have a partner. But the reality is that you struggle to get honest feedback. And so you have to give yourself feedback, and that's okay. Your peers don't really see you working. You know, we like to say that if you want a recommendation for a surgeon, don't ask another surgeon, ask the anesthetist. Yeah. Because anesthetists work with a lot of surgeons, but surgeons almost never work with other surgeons. Yeah. And the point there, of course, is that there's nobody there who has time to watch you.
Yeah.
And so as an anesthetist, I've watched, I don't know, thousands of hours of surgeons. And I see stuff that I'm sure could be valuable to a surgeon, but rarely, if ever, have I ever asked about that input.
Yeah. These are golden nuggets, aren't they? And I think it's quite difficult because we all become so defensive when we're given feedback. And it's almost Max Planck's sort of quote about the older generation dying off, because the newer generation are used to this constant scrutiny.
Yeah.
And they've learnt to possibly a little bit better to give meaningful feedback and then reflect on it. You mentioned the word reflection as an important part of our learning process.
Yeah.
So, you know, several companies are designing now black boxes for our theatres. You know, the only mark of success for my theatre is the patient comes in, the doors close, and the patient comes out alive. Hooray. But we are now looking at the processes in theatre. And you know, we know that about 40% of adverse events in surgery in the theatre are due to miscommunications, etc. So just tell me about that psychological effect of being continuously monitored. And also what you've just said, you know, how do we get feedback to senior people?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have the old famous Hawthorne effect, where when people are watching you initially, your performance improves and then it kind of plateaus. And then if you feel completely overwhelmed by it, your performance seems to degrade. What's really interesting about Hawthorne is that that was in a plant in Hawthorne, and it was, you know, blue collar workers, so a slightly different model. But I'd like to draw lessons from high performing aviation teams like the Israeli military or Arsenal or other teams that are constantly being scrutinized, constantly being filmed. Everything about them, their nutrition, their sleep habits, everything is being monitored and fed back to them. The key message, not just track, but they can see. For example, the best soccer players in the Premier League have watches and apps where everything about their daily performance is given back to them. They can see how many reps they did. They can see how well their running was. And so, in some of them say they have too much feedback because it's a lot of information, right? And part of the problem in the OR is that we're so afraid of any performance variance that we're missing out on the incredible learning opportunities. Yeah. We've discovered from our studies that when you observe teams, particularly if you do so in a way that's nurturing and not threatening, they are glad to have you observe them. And after a few moments, they forget that you're there. In fact, we've had incidents and we've had observers in the OR where they will ask them if they can give them a hand to move the patient from the bed to the trolley. They completely forget that they are separate. They invite them into the team. And so I think that we are moving rapidly towards a world of regular CCTV monitoring.
Yeah.
Now the question is, are we going to be wise enough to use that to learn, to train? You know, there's multiple studies now in surgery in which surgeons have been given anonymous feedback on their videos of their cases. I can imagine that will be a regular practice. So the OR record will have a combination of what we have now, plus video links, you know, measurement links, feedback from team members. And so it will be a whole meal. So when you finish a 1-hour laparoscopic case, you might have enough material to, for multiple hours, to improve your standing, your position, your speaking, entrance time. You know, we're using now a Deming model of timing various elements. So right now we have many delays from the moment the patient is scheduled for surgery until they leave the hospital. We've drilled down to about 26 different separate timings. Some of them are being collected, others are not. When we start collecting them and we give feedback to team members, for example, we're able to turn over the OR much faster. We've gone from 47 minutes down to 24 minutes.
Wow.
We're able to get people in different places of the hospital with much more awareness, because now the trolley movers, the hospital people, the clinicians, they're all in awareness. So the surgeon doesn't have to wait until the patient's there. In real time, they get a notification and they're part of a WhatsApp thing that the anesthetist, surgeon, nurse, trolley, everybody is all on the same network. And they go, okay, patient will be in the room in 2 minutes. The surgeon knows a real 2 minutes, not surgeon gets there. Where's the anesthetist? They're in the coffee break.
Yeah.
Anesthetist was there 10 minutes earlier. They said, oh, well, the surgeon's late. I'm going to go have my coffee now. And so suddenly a 2-minute delay becomes a 20-minute delay because nobody trusts the date, the timings, because we've all been conditioned. It's fine. There's no urgency. And so ultimately now the surgeon can't plan their clinic because they're backed up with the previous. Now they're stressed out between cases, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
that's the type of feedback I would love surgeons and teams to get and truly have team debriefing. One of my biggest pet peeves, Ted, I don't know if it's different in your hospital, but that surgeons, nurses, anesthetists all do post-OR learning separately.
Yeah.
We never meet. And guess who the anesthetists blame when there's a problem and the surgeons aren't in the room? And equally, the surgeons blame the anesthetists. And so we got to start learning as a team. And that means allocating time for the team to learn together, sit together. It doesn't have to be a lot of time, but I think it has to be a regular timing that we meet to share, to break bread, to learn about how this case could have been refined, both the technical stuff, but as you said, the non-technical communication, coordination, collaboration, crisis management, stress management, all these other soft skills that we know that surgical team members are in great need of training and support.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're describing is actually learning the job, living the job, and loving the job. It's so important. So we're coming to the end of our time. I could honestly sit and talk to you for a lot longer. I probably will. But just tell me, so we really touched on the PTSD, the moral injury. So just as a summary, in terms of sustainability of the surgeon, and for that, I guess that's a surrogate for the team, because that's what we are really. What are your three takeaways that you would say we need to get from your learnings, your experience?
Number one, we have to have honest conversations about the psychological wellness of surgical team members. Yep. We cannot view extraordinary stress, as COVID has shown us, with studies showing 50% of workers having major depressive symptoms, 50%. You know, we need to be able to acknowledge that mental wellness is as important as physical wellness as it relates to the readiness of the team, number one. So that means removing the stigma. That means making it safe to talk about this. It's okay to say, I need to get home to my wife because my marital situation is terrible because I'm in the hospital all day long. There's nobody there with the kids. My wife is getting annoyed. My husband, my wife. We need to have safe ways to talk about this in a way that will not necessarily reflect on that we'll lose our job or get censured or get marginalized.
Psychological safety.
Psychological safety. Absolutely. Number two is the idea that we must acknowledge that the unit of measurement is the team. If the team is not supporting and working well, the surgeon can have good outcomes. If the team is not able to speak up, they're not able to give a good word, they're not able to lean in. You know, these although we've been able to develop a sophisticated anesthesia surgery and nursing lanes, so much of it intersects with each other. And so we have to think about the cross-training. When I was doing my cardiac anesthesia training, I spent a week working as a perfusionist. I'm not a perfusionist, but I know so much more about perfusion because I sat in their shoes for a week. I understand when they need help. I can work the perfusion machine in a pinch. And because I actually put my hands on the knobs and I'm able to say, give me another round. So I understand some of the constraints. So I can support them when they need help. It used to be that many, many surgeons in training would spend a month doing anesthesia. Most of that has disappeared in the US. We don't really do that anymore. And I think surgeons are poor off and the system is poor off because the surgeons have less of an understanding of the insecurities and vulnerabilities and pain points that the anesthetists have before the starting of the case, during the case, and after the case. So interprofessional training, I think, is really essential. Okay. The third thing is that we have to get much better at giving feedback to surgical team members. That means reporting, debriefing, quantitatively, qualitatively. We have to get better at understanding that without learning, there cannot be improved performance. Without a culture of safety, there can't be honest learning. So these are really, really important aspects of that, that really ends with my final thing, which I call the four T's. If we're going to have effective teams, we have to start telling the truth. We can't tell the truth unless we're transparent about the data, and people will not tell the truth unless there's a trusting environment. So trust, transparency, and truthfulness is the heart of all teams, and especially high-performance surgical teams. And I think that's part of the secret to help protect surgeons from getting moral injury, burnout, and stress, because it's at an all-time high. And we need to protect these remarkable performers. And we do so not by ignoring their work, but by supporting them, by making it safe for them to take breaks, by supporting their balance between work and play. And finally, by helping them go back to that joy, that being, you know, into that space of really performing at the top of their game in order to achieve the remarkable work and results that they're able to achieve.
That's really fascinating. Psychological safety, the team, meaningful feedback. And you mentioned truth, transparency, trust for the team. Paul Barak, thank you very much for joining me in Through the Keyhole.
Real pleasure, Dan.
for joining Through the Keyhole. You will find more interesting podcasts in this series, as well as online resources from the ALS GBI at www.alsgbi.org.